So, oh, ladies and gentlemen, here we have the wonderful screenwriter, aka ghostwriter, aka the man who survived Hollywood, Neil Gumpel. It's a quite a pleasure to have you here, Neil.
Yeah, we've talked so many times. This is very different. This is a whole different thing where I'm on somebody's show.
This is a great thing. I know I've been bugging you for a while to interview you because I started out on here. This is where we met, you know. Social media is a beautiful thing. So we met here. And I was very much, I think it was, you were maybe a few days into TikTok when I first noticed some of your reels. And it was something unique. It was something that I've never seen before. Basically, you said things that were so unorthodox. You know, you basically, you shocked me into reality with the inner workings of Hollywood. So I was immediately hooked, as was many others, because you have like 35,000 followers or more by now. So Neil, enough about all the this and the that. Tell us about you. Tell us how you got started for those of you who may not know you.
Well, first of all, let me just say about the TikTok. The TikTok started coming out of COVID, the writer's strike, all the shit was going on. And Julius, a young man, came along and said, you should do TikTok. So he dragged me kicking and screaming into this. And I was just doing garden videos. And before you know it, morphed to Hollywood. So that's when I met you. You were one of the first people in the room. And it became something from there. No, I accidentally became a screenwriter in my mid-30s, which is very late to enter the business. And it was just a big accident, really. That's the terrifying part of my story. I accidentally became a screenwriter through director Jim Sheridan, who found my first story. And it wasn't in a screenplay form. It was just a story written on a yellow pad that I pulled out of my ass all of a sudden. And by accident, Jim Sheridan came in the apartment looking to sublet the apartment in Manhattan for his daughter. Next thing you know, he picked it up and crazy things happened within a few weeks. He said, this is a movie. I was working in the Citarella Fish Market up on Broadway, 74th and Broadway. And next thing you know, he said, you got to go with me to Toronto Film Festival, to Hollywood and everything. So I was very, very lucky, kind of. I would have been better if I stayed at the fish market because they were nice. You know, all the overtime you wanted, you know. I had a nice apartment there. But it was an adventure. I entered into a crazy adventure. So...
Yeah. So you started out very humbly without. So this is the funny part. This is why I got to laugh because you know,
I wasn't humble.
No. From fish market to hanging out with Bono and all these crazies that I'll go. I mean, this is what I love about your stories because and for anybody who doesn't know, again, I mean, this is all true. This is all true stuff here. You know, you actually became a big screenwriter. By accident, more or less by accident, because you had you had the gift, let's face it, but it took Sheridan to kind of, to be, he was the one who illuminated your path. He was, you know, the Virgil for your story.
Yeah, well, what happened was, working in the fish market, I was probably on the verge of a nervous breakdown, as always, and I'm in the fish market. This guy, this little Irish guy, takes my yellow pad with him to Ireland, calls me up 2 weeks later at work, which pissed my boss off, Joe Guerrero, who owns Citarella. He says, it's a phone call for you. This is a Sunday at like 6 o'clock at night. I'm like, I'm sorry. I thought it was a family emergency. And Jim said, you have to be in Toronto in the morning. So through a series of crazy things that went on, I agreed to go to Toronto the following morning. And, I was having a late breakfast with Kevin Bacon and his wife and Liam Neeson and a few other people by 11:30 in the morning in Toronto. And then when I got done with 2 days of this crazy, and I didn't know what was going on, Jim just kept saying, I'm going to do your movie. I'm going to do your movie. I'm like, what movie are you talking about? There's this story that was on a yellow pad. He goes, "We're gonna do your movie, but we gotta get the right director." He had Steve Buscemi talking to me. I didn't know what the fuck anybody's talking about, you know. And then I said, "Okay, well, this is over. I'm going home." I go home. "No, you can't go home. You gotta go to Hollywood with me and Liam, and we're all going to Hollywood." I'm like, "Holy crap!" Next thing you know, I'm at Chateau Marmont with these guys, crazy maniacs, and so it's an interesting story. But in a perfect world, if I had to make the right decision, I would have gone to Toronto, taken the $10,000 check they gave me, kept my job at the fish market, and then balanced the two worlds.
Maybe just write on spec or whatever.
Well,
And just.
they were throwing money at me. They opened up a bank, Park Avenue, with the Bank of Ireland or Bank of Dublin, Park Avenue, whatever the frig the bank was. And I was
And
like,
so.
suddenly, like, you know.
And so it brought you into, it threw you into a whole other world, a very chaotic world, a very exciting but chaotic world. Chateau Marmont, I know where that's at. Unfortunately, I never went there, even though I lived in LA for a while. I don't know why, but I never went in there. But Chateau Marmont is very historic. All the big stars and the golden era and silver era of Hollywood. Everybody's been there.
Yeah, that's where people go to jump. They go to jump off the place. It's that kind of a place.
It's yeah, it's one of those big lavish places that's probably haunted by a series of old stars or whatever. But it's also a town where now. Of course, now let's not get too far ahead of ourselves, though. Let's talk about some of the stuff that's really interesting to a lot of the people. You talked about Joe Pesci. I wanted to get into that a little bit because that was a fantastic story about the screenplay that you wrote, and how did the whole thing go down with Sid Rivers?
Well, I've told this on the TikToks before, but there's another part of the story which I never covered, and I always meant to. So I first got to Hollywood, and I was boom, DreamWorks, everything, selling stuff. And all of a sudden I realized, okay, I sold the movie to DreamWorks, and I had the first one with Sheridan, and it became apparent to me that things aren't going to happen right away. It could be 5, 6 years before they do my movie. So I went back to New York and had nothing to do. So I took a job as a clerk in a bookie office down in the Garment District. Basically, it's all, you know, crime, but basically it's you sit in an office, you know, with soundproofing with about 12 guys who smell like donkeys, and you're in an enclosed room so many hours a day. Taking, you know, and so I was doing that. And the characters in these rooms are, looking back, these are some of the funniest, most interesting people you've ever met who become bookies. And at the time, there were no cell phones. You get on a real phone, you take the bets, write the ticket out. This and that. At the end of the day, you go out to Palm or whatever, Sparks for dinner, tons of cash. They give you just a stack of cash at the end of the week. And if my kids are listening, I'm not proud of this, kids, but just letting you know. It was something to keep me busy and make some money. So while there, I encountered this elderly gentleman who was just this, he was just a slob. That's all I could say. I've never seen such an unkempt slob. And everybody made fun of him. He was always late. His pants were falling down. He always had cream cheese on. He was just a slob. And over months, I came very close to him. His name was Philly. Well, we didn't know whose anybody's name was. My name wasn't Neil. My name was Teddy Kopp, because they'd assign you a name when you walk and say, "You." I looked like Ted Koppel with the haircut at the time. So he said, "You're Teddy Kopp, and you don't have a choice. You're Teddy Kopp." They never wanted to know your real name. So Phil, I became very attached to this older gentleman. He's very funny and sweet. But he was so good at the whole bookie thing. He was like one of the odds callers. People call from around the country. What's Phil going to do? He'd look at the games. He'd say, over four, you know, over 20, you know, this team over this team by some. And his opinion mattered, and it would adjust the national numbers would shift based upon what Phil would say.
He's a handicapper.
Yeah, that's yes. So you know more than I do. I know nothing about sports, by the way, when I was taking this job. I didn't know the Yankees from anything. So I just got very close to the guy. And it was somewhere maybe 6, 7 months into the job one day. I saw him. He was very emotional one day. And I approached him, you know, something wrong. He just fessed up that he was having trouble with work. I said, what do you mean with work? He didn't want anybody to know this, but he told me that he's an elementary school teacher in Harlem. He teaches math to like fourth graders, fourth and fifth graders in Harlem. He's just this big, bald Jewish guy. I'm like, what? This is the guy you would never think in a million years of this guy being around children or animals or anything. You'd be like, what? Yeah, he's a math teacher. He's been a math teacher in Harlem for 30 years. And he was very upset because his students love him and he loves his students. Even students from years ago come back to visit him, you know? And I'm like, holy crap. And meanwhile, now I'm a screenwriter, so now I'm looking for ideas. So that was the birth of Sid Rivers. And then I got to know more about his world, and he always kept the worlds apart. School people never knew anything about his world. And all the bookies and the mobsters and everything, nobody knew anything about his life during the day. Nobody knew anything except for me. So in time, it was such a beautiful story. I just said, this is a friggin' movie. So I wrote the movie, the script. And it's funny because it's all the characters in the room and all the crazy shit that goes on. And then I put it away because I said, I don't know if they're going to approve of this, if this is okay. It's a very inside look at how it happens. And I waited for years. I waited for years. I just put it away until my friend read it. My friend Paulie Herman read it. This is like years later.
Neil, not to interrupt you, but for those who may not know, who was Paul Herman? I know who he is, but who? Try to guess who he was. Paul Herman.
Paulie Herman was. He's a very, you know, familiar face. Everything from Goodfellas. He has that short scene in Goodfellas where he talks about the helicopters. Ray Liotta comes in about they come in the helicopters, and Paul Herman goes, "Yeah, the helicopters." He was Robert De Niro's. He always was Robert De Niro's closest friend. We talk about friends. He was his most trusted person to the point where, when De Niro opened up the restaurant Ago in Hollywood. Along with Weinstein and a couple other people, he said to Paul, he says, I need you in that restaurant every night for at least a few hours to watch my interests. Paulie Herman went on to do a lot of movies. He was in The Sopranos. He
Right, he was
played
Beansy. He was his character's name was Beansy in The Sopranos.
Beansy. Yeah, he gets beat up really bad and run over and shit.
By
Yeah.
Dave Proval, who my dear friend Sal's very friendly with Dave Proval, who we're trying to get in the Pasta and Cheech crew, but we still gotta figure that out.
Yeah, well, it's so funny because Paulie did that, and then years toward the end of his life, he did that movie Silver Linings with what's his name? Silver Linings, the movie. I'm not good with names of movies, as you know. But he co-starred in that with he co-starred in that movie, the Silver Lining movie, whatever the frig the name of that movie is.
Right.
So he read it. And Paulie used to read all my scripts. He was an avid reader of scripts. I'd say, you don't have to. He goes, no, I want to read it. Didn't come back to me with all kinds of ideas. And he said to me, he goes, could I show this to Joe Pesci? I'm like, really? Because he was good friends. Friggin' dog's barking outside. It's not my dog. So anyway, I said, yeah, you can show it. To show Paul, I mean,
Joe
Frank.
Pesci, yeah.
Oh, Joe. I said, for what? He goes, well, he could play, you know. He goes, I don't know, maybe he'll just produce it. I said, okay, whatever. A couple nights later, he calls me, says, come down to Ago. I get down there, Joe Pesci's there, and we sit down. He goes, you know, kid, I loved it. This is the best script I've seen in years. And he wasn't working at the time. He's like, I want to do this movie. I want to play Sid. And at the time, this is one of the things I talk about. Like, I've made every mistake there is. technically that was a mistake. Although, who's going to say no to Joe Pesci, you know, and his lawyer with a checkbook? He said, I want to do this movie. It's okay. So my lawyer got involved. They signed a deal. He optioned Sid Rivers from me. And within weeks, this is the crazy thing, within weeks, Arthur Penn came out of retirement, the famous Arthur Penn, to direct that movie. That's how much he liked the movie. So that's how that got started, through Paulie Herman, who was overseeing. He was like the social maitre d' of Iago, and he put me together with Joe Pesci.
So here you are, you're in Hollywood, you just optioned a screenplay, and you wrote with you what you knew. See, again, you write what you know, you're in that environment with those people in that world, and you put pen to paper, and you came up with a screenplay that excited Joe Pesci, and so much so that he optioned it. For those that don't know what that means, an option means you're basically buying the rights to it for a certain period of time for a certain amount of money. When it expires, then it goes back to the writer.
Right.
So then what happens? So now you're feeling good. You got a few bucks, but you're looking forward to making this thing a reality. And then what happens?
Well, it was moving very fast, because once Arthur Penn came on, I mean, the world was like, Arthur Penn's coming out of retirement to do this movie. Even people like, everybody was coming up to me. Everyone was hearing that Arthur Penn's doing my movie. That's all they needed to know. And Warren Beatty almost like suffocated me one night. He goes, you wrote that? Because he's friends with Arthur Penn from Bonnie and Clyde. They're still friends. They were still friends. So, yeah, I felt great because I could finally call my kids. I said, listen, I know you're full of crap. I know you think I'm full of crap. Finally, I have a movie going. They set a date. It was like we had an office set up down near the World Trade Center. Great location at the time. Right down there was an office set up. We had storyboards up. I walked in this room with all these people bustling about, and assistants. You know, Arthur Penn's room is over here with the storyboards of my movie up there. The movie was going. It was going, you know. It was like a $10 million budget. So, I was pretty friggin' happy. And then Arthur Penn wanted to do a rewrite on the script, and that was terrifying. Because I figured, well, let me just mosey on up to his house on the Upper West Side. He said to come over on Saturday. I didn't get what time it was, you know. And I got there, and he's like, you're late. Why are you late? I'm like, oh, Jesus, this is like Catholic school all over again. You're late, sit down. I'd like to meet your wife. Never mind my wife. Sit down. Like, the guy started yelling at me. And he proceeded to show me how to rewrite a script or fix a script with a red pen. Why did you say this? Well, I just thought, yeah, that's a waste of time. That's, you know, he went through the script like we did a rewrite of the script in 3 hours. He showed me to cut the shit out of a script. You don't need to say this thing 2 or 3 times. You could say this with the camera. You don't need to say this. He doesn't need to say this. Just show it. Just like, it was like a crash course in screenwriting and directing. I almost cried. It was like brutal. So anyway, so everything was fine until like 2 weeks later, Arthur Penn's calling me. Do you know what that son of a bitch? I'm like, what's wrong? Meanwhile, I'm wining and dining in Westchester with my kids, hanging out. You know, let's go on the boat, take a ride. You know, the world's wonderful. All of a sudden, he goes, that son of a bitch. he wants Sid to take the kids to the racetrack. I'm like, what? Well, Joe thinks that he should take the kid, his class, to the racetrack. I'm like, well, that's crazy. He goes, yeah, I know it's crazy. I told that little, you know, swearing. I told that little fuck, Sid would never, like, it was far crazier than I've told him. Then I contact Pesci's attorney. I said, what's going on? He goes, well, Joe just wants to be able to, like, you know, tweak things. I said, yeah, but this is Arthur Penn. Arthur Penn. Okay, no, you don't know Joe. Joe's really crazy about this stuff. He thinks he should take his class to a racetrack. I said, but Sid wouldn't fucking do that. That's why we like Sid, because Sid loves his children and protects them from that world. That's what the movie's about. Well, you know Joe. No, I don't know Joe. I just know that he's nuts. I've seen him in Goodfellas. That's all I know. Is he gonna beat me up? I don't know. Well, that wasn't bad enough. But the other part of the story, and I briefed you on this, that you didn't hear this. At the same time, Joe just got an attitude. And then he said, well, I want $4 million to do the movie. So Richard Brick, the producer, was like, what are you talking about? You own it. This is your movie. You own the rights. You transfer the rights to the Rai Entertainment in Italy was going to be financing it. But you own it. You're the one who's going to be making all the money. He goes, I don't care. I need $4 million. And we're like, next thing you know, Rick's yelling at me on the phone. That son of a bitch, he wants to pay himself $4 million of the $10 million. We can't do that. We're shooting in New York. Because what he should have taken was scale plus 10%. Pay himself something, you know. And I'm like, my head, that was about the most stressful thing. I mean, DreamWorks falling apart, selling a movie to Spielberg, watching that fall apart, that's okay. All the other, but that one, we were right there. We had the office. We had the little cute girls running around the office. We had the whole thing. And all of a sudden, I'm talking to Arthur Penn. Arthur Penn, I need this like a hole in the head. That's why I came out of retirement. I don't need this bullshit. You could tell that little son of a. And the whole thing. And I remember my last phone call was talking to Richard Brick. I'm like, is there anything I can do? He goes, no. I produced all of Woody Allen's movies. I've done all this. I've been in the business enough to know this is over. I said, but can I talk this? No, you can't do anything. It's over. He said, the script will be yours in 6 months. You can do whatever you want with it. I'm like, oh, Fungo. Like, oh. It was a disaster. It was a disaster.
And there goes a classic, a classic example of the crap that goes on in Hollywood, probably more often than people realize, and how egotism and personalities will prevent not just others, but even themselves from making a fortune.
Well, I've heard a lot of people tell me since then, they said you never option a script to an actor. Like, if you think this actor would be great and he loves the script, you just can't go and option it to the actor.
Stay tuned for part two with Neil Gumbel.